The abandoned NEPA shack afforded such an ideal crow's nest for surveillance that Bill Nellist and Rufo Vakilar decided to remain there all day. Nellist figured someone ought to keep an eye on things, and besides, having two more men clamber down from the shack in daylight hours was risky. With too much coming and going, the Japanese would eventually become suspicious. So he and Vakilar intended to hide out until the attack was nearly underway, and then leap into the fields at dusk to join the rangers and other scouts as they crept toward the prison. Nellist sat in silence and anxiously scanned the camp, his M1 propped on the windowsill. In the village of Platero, 2 miles to the north, Colonel Musi and Prince received Nellist's intelligence report with enormous relief. It was 2:30 on the afternoon of January 30th. Late, almost too late. Finally, the rangers could set to work in earnest. When Prince dug into the Nellist report, it became clear that whatever the scouts had been doing across the river, they hadn't been loitering. Prince was astounded at the depth of detail. All the crucial points Musi had asked for, and numerous ones he hadn't even considered, were in there. Given what Prince already knew about the terrain, it was hard to fathom how the scouts had been able to gather such rich particularity. The report may have taken a little longer than they would have liked, but this was impeccable recon work, accomplished against great odds. With this fresh information in hand, the master plan quickly took shape in Prince's mind. All day he'd been thinking about it and discussing it with the various platoon leaders, but it hadn't all crystallized for him until now. He sketched it out as a diagram in his notebook, and at 3 o'clock he submitted the plan to Musi. It didn't take long for the colonel to sign off on it. At 4 o'clock, a meeting of all the rangers was called. With the sun dropping fast, the time had come to lay out in full detail the final version of the master plan, and to make all the individual assignments. The rangers were to set out in 1 hour's time, and now the men were lost in the private reveries and ritualistic tics of imminent combat, checking sidearms, filling bandoliers, synchronizing watches. Beneath a clump of shade trees, the various non-coms and platoon leaders huddled with their weapons, waiting intently to hear what Musi and Prince had in mind. Captain Prince's plan was intricate. As he elaborated the details, he clutched a stick and scratched out diagrams in the soft dirt. At Musi's signal, the rangers would clear out of Platero and march south toward the camp, flanked by Pahota's 200 men on one side and Hosan's 80 men on the other. Just before reaching the Pampanga River, the two guerrilla groups would break off from the rangers. Pahota's forces would bear sharply to the left. Their task would be to set up a massive roadblock on Highway 5, about a mile northeast of the camp, near the Kabu River Bridge. Precisely at 7:40, they were to destroy the bridge with landmines, which Pahota's explosives experts would have already set among the span's log pylons. Just across the river, more than 1,000 Imperial Army soldiers would still be bivouacked down in the bamboo thickets. Should they charge toward the POW camp upon hearing the ranger fire, Pahota's men would be there, waiting in ambush, reinforced with a bazooka to hold any Japanese tanks at bay. Lining themselves across the road and facing the bridge in a classic open V, Pahota's guerrillas would proceed to cut down the enemy with enfilading fire. Captain Hosen's job would be, in a sense, the mirror opposite of Pahota's. He and his forces would peel off toward the right and erect another roadblock on Highway 5, this one just south of the camp, to stop any Japanese troops that might hasten from Cabanatuan City. Here, the Japanese threat was less imminent, since Cabanatuan was 4 miles away, but potentially far greater than for Pahota's men at the Kabu River Bridge, as there were said to be as many as 8,000 of Yamashita's best soldiers stationed in the city. Hosen, too, would have bazookas and landmines at his disposal, but if Japanese forces were to get early notice of the raid and attack en masse, his men might soon be overwhelmed. This part of the plan was exceedingly risky, but Pahota and Hosen, working in tandem, had to seal off a solid mile of the road and hold it long enough for the rangers to attack the camp, remove the prisoners, and then cross back over, melting safely into the rice paddies in the deepening night. The two Filipino forces, in other words, were to function as a synchronized pair of shut-off valves in a great water main, temporarily blocking the flow in both directions, so the Rangers could go in and do their extraction work with little worry of a surprise surge in the pipe. For the Rangers, though, reaching the camp would pose a much more immediate problem. For the last mile beyond the Pampanga on the bald plain, they had to crawl on their stomachs in the hope of escaping detection. As they approached the highway, the 30 members of F Company would then break left from Prince's larger group to sneak around to the back of the camp, creeping along a dry ravine that was, they hoped, deep enough to conceal them from Japanese sentinels. The F Company men would position themselves to fire on the rear guard towers and pillboxes, as well as on the Japanese barracks, which were believed to house several hundred transient soldiers. F Company would fire first, just as the sun was setting, at about 7:30, and this opening salvo would serve as the cue for Prince's C Company to leap across the road and kill the guards in the towers while simultaneously storming the main gate. Once the gate was breached, a first wave of men would race down the camp's central thoroughfare, pivot right, and then riddle the Japanese side with a merciless barrage of automatic fire from Tommy guns and BARs. Then the bazooka team would penetrate deeper into the compound and destroy the metal shed where the scouts believed the tanks were parked. Japanese resistance quelled, a final wave of men would push in with wire cutters and free the prisoners, with a reserve of Rangers and Alamo scouts waiting at the front gate to escort the escapees to the Pampanga River, where carabao and civilian-driven oxcarts would be waiting. Captain Prince would direct the traffic and oversee the action while standing at the threshold of the main gate. As the stream of exiting POWs trickled off, he would personally go in to inspect each barracks to make sure every last prisoner had been removed. Once satisfied of that, he would fire a red flare high over the camp, the signal to all participants that the assault was over. After the column of Rangers and POWs had successfully crossed the Pampanga, Prince would fire a second red flare, this one assigned to both guerrilla groups, to commence their withdrawals. Then the hardest part. At the river, the Rangers and POWs would embark on their 30-mile trudge north toward American lines, passing through Platero on the way, with the guerrillas serving as rear guard. It promised to be a long, slow trek of moonlight marching, but by dawn they should be scot-free in the Sixth Army's embrace. This was the essence of Prince's design for the raid. In the pitch dark, with so much thunderous gunfire and scurrying back and forth, it might appear to be a melee, but it was all to be carefully choreographed, with the major action of the raid taking no more than 30 minutes. Organized confusion was how Prince described it. "We wanted all hell to break loose," he said, "but to break loose precisely on our terms." The captain was confident in the broad strokes, but what concerned him was the high level of coordination that the plan required without benefit of any sort of dry run. It was a sustained and intensive collaboration involving so many disparate groups, Rangers, Scouts, two separate guerrilla organizations, Filipino civilians, POWs, not to mention the lowly, shambling water buffalo. All told, the raid would employ a cast of nearly 1,000 characters, every one of whom had to do his job and do it correctly, or else the mission hung in jeopardy. The individual tasks seemed straightforward enough, but taken as a whole, the operation had to unfold as an intricate progression, each action building on the success of the previous one, each stage driving ineluctably toward the next, like tricky interlocking patterns of tipping dominoes. It was such a complex group of people, none of whom had had any real dealings with one another before, not on such a scale, Prince said. The main thing that made it conceivable to think we could succeed was that we were in friendly territory with friendly people. Trying to do that somewhere else, I don't think you could even come close. Prince and Musi would give the platoon leaders wide latitude in assigning the teams and ordering specific tasks to be performed by their subordinate enlisted men. Of all the different components of the plan, what worried the platoon leaders most was the approach itself. That long, slow crawl to the gate gave off a faint whiff of suicide. The The Japanese would still have ample light to see the Rangers as they wriggled to their final positions in the fields. How could the men expect to escape the notice of the guards? It seemed an insoluble problem. Here, Captain Pahota spoke up. Over the past few weeks, he said, his guerrillas had noticed something interesting. It appeared that the Japanese guards at the camp were unusually agitated by the specter of American planes flying overhead. The planes would roar into view, and even if they were just innocuous little Piper Cubs, the guards would excitedly scour the skies. Why not call in a few American planes to buzz the camp in the last moments leading up to the raid, purely as a diversion? It might distract the Japanese sentries just long enough for the Rangers to sneak into their positions. Instead of looking down, the guards would be looking up. "No shooting, no bombs," said Pahota. "Just fly over." Musi instantly liked the sound of it. As with Pahota's suggestion of using carabao carts, the idea was novel, even a little odd, yet at the same time compellingly simple. Air cover not as a defense, but as a decoy, a gaze averter. The aircraft would just be up there, looping and droning and turning, flummoxing the guards, commanding their attention. It might at least buy the Rangers more time. Musi felt it was well worth breaking radio silence to request that 6th Army Headquarters scramble a plane. The mighty U.S. Army was not always known for its lightning reflexes, however, and at this late hour it seemed unlikely that a plane and pilot could be assigned in time to do any good. Still, Musi decided it was worth a try. He had the radio operator call in the request. In back of all the many doubts and contingencies Musi had to grapple with, one outcome seemed certain. With an assignment as perilous as this, there were bound to be casualties. Musi made sure Dr. Jimmy Fisher, the battalion surgeon, was well prepared. Fisher had spent the better part of the day turning the one-room schoolhouse of Platero into a makeshift hospital. Fisher had befriended a local Filipino doctor, Carlos Nugid Layug, who agreed to help conduct surgeries, dress wounds, and do whatever else was needed. Trained in Manila before the war, the 37-year-old Layug was an experienced army physician from the Bataan battlefields, a survivor of the death march, in fact, and he'd spent the past 3 years surreptitiously serving as the surgeon for Captain Pahota's insurgents. During those years, he had encountered just about every sort of trauma and malady the war could throw at a young doctor, and he'd learned to work miracles with scant supplies, rudimentary equipment, and no money whatsoever. When Layug treated patients, he was usually accompanied by his wife, Julita, who was also a surgeon, every bit as competent and resourceful as he. By mid-afternoon, with a bit of jury-rigging and the generous donations of locals, Fisher and the Layugs had completed their metamorphosis of the school. They'd pulled together teachers' desks to function as operating tables. They'd collected dozens of spare bed linens and hung blankets over the windows to keep out the bluebottle flies and the glare. The hospital was as ready as it was ever going to be, the packets of morphine and gauze and syringes arrayed on side tables, containers of plasma carefully stockpiled, scalpels sparkling in the guttering light of coconut oil lamps. Dr. Fisher had decided he would personally participate in the raid, crawling along with everyone else to the very threshold of the prison. This was a bit unorthodox. Many other battalion surgeons would have chosen to stay at the hospital and wait for the medics to bring the casualties in. Musi didn't like it at all. "You're crazy, Jimmy," Musi told him. "This is a raid. We can't have you in there." Musi argued that Fisher's skills were far too important to risk on the line, that an injured surgeon wouldn't be of much use to the company in its hour of greatest need. But the doctor turned Musi's argument on its head. Fisher thought he should go along precisely because this was such a dangerous mission. He felt strongly that he'd be needed right from the start, at the gate, in situ. Moreover, Fisher doubted whether his small team of 4 medical corpsmen could handle the job if casualties mounted. He felt his expertise might be crucial in helping to stabilize patients and save lives outside the compound. There was also the question of the POWs themselves. "You've got 500 prisoners in there. Many of them are terribly ill and might require special medical attention from the outset," Fisher told Musi. Then, too, Fisher contended, Dr. Liug and his wife were more than qualified to stay in Platero and staff the hospital while he was out in the field. Fisher was persuasive, and ultimately Musi relented. The young surgeon's stubbornness on this point reflected something of his character. Ever since he joined the Rangers in New Guinea, he'd consistently been the kind of soft-spoken, self-deprecating doctor who expected to be treated the same as everyone else, to march the same marches, to venture out on the same patrols, to get himself into the same physical shape as his Ranger comrades. He hated the pretentiousness typical of so many Army surgeons, and always insisted that even the greenest of enlisted men address him simply as Dr. Jimmy. Perhaps it was in part his way of compensating for his Harvard medical education and his privileged upbringing as the son of the popular Vermont writer and educator Dorothy Canfield Fisher, one of the charter committee members of the Book of the Month Club. With 5 o'clock fast approaching, Dr. Fisher hurriedly pulled together a rucksack of emergency medical supplies and waited for Colonel Musi's signal to march. The Pampanga River spills cold from the mountains of northern Luzon and courses south through the rice country before emptying into Manila Bay as a broad, mazy delta of brackish channels, aquaculture ponds, and mangrove swamps. The longest river in Luzon, the Rio Grande de la Pampanga, as it is sometimes called, is the island's central drainage, flowing thick with silt and volcanic ash. Much of the year, the Pampanga runs swift and wide and deep, and even in the dry days of January, it can be a treacherous stream in places, especially if pulsed by a surprise winter storm. For most of the dry season, however, the river braids quietly through the long reaches of the central plain, the turbid water swirling around sandbars, skimming low along the banks. As the Rangers approached the Pampanga at 5:15 on the afternoon of Tuesday, January 30th, shortly after leaving Platero, they were pleased to confront the river in its more placid, winterized state. Spread out before them was a modest stream, gently churning through a dry floodplain several hundred yards wide. Standing at the banks, Musi realized that the raid on Cabanatuan, as it had been planned, would not have been possible in any other season. Hauling his men and equipment across the royal of a fully engorged Pampanga would have been logistically difficult at best, while attempting to ferry 500 weak prisoners back across would have been unthinkably dangerous. Even now, the river was chin-high in places, the current formidable. Musi anxiously scanned the skies to make sure no thunderclouds were mounting on the horizon. "I prayed that there wouldn't be any rain before we got back," he would later write, "because it was the kind of river that could rise a couple of feet in a very short time." Fortunately, Pahota's guides were familiar with the spot in the Pampanga where the main stream forked into two shallower streams that coursed around a small island of silt. The current in these two subsidiary streams was weaker, and at their deepest points, the waters rose only to the men's thighs. Marching single file with their rifles clutched over their heads, the Rangers easily forded the first stream, tramped over the soft sandbar, and then waded across the second channel to the far banks. While the Rangers slipped across the river, Pahota's force split off to the left and Hosen's men to the right, each group vanishing in the bamboo thickets along the banks. Musi was more than a little concerned about the guerrillas. Never having worked with them before, he could only hope that they had the training, the wherewithal, and inclination to hold the road for as long as it took. His skepticism wasn't merely grounded in U.S. Army chauvinism. Guerrilla warfare, with its reliance on small-scale sniping, lightning ambush, and subterfuge, was vastly different from the sort of fixed battle that the guerrillas were now preparing to wage along Highway 5. Musi worried that in a direct confrontation with elite Japanese troops, the guerrillas might prematurely bolt, overwhelmed by the sustained potency of a well-trained, well-equipped regular army. It took 15 minutes for the long file of Rangers to ford the warm brown waters of the Pampanga. Their pant legs soaked, they emerged from the muddy river into a Kogan field. They were in high spirits. After holding up for nearly 24 hours in Platero, they found an almost giddy sense of release in forward movement, in the simple camaraderie of marching again. As the men walked, Musi strode up and down the column, slapping backs, rallying with his staccato pep talk. He was a bantam, surging with resolve, the oldest man of the lot, and yet stoked with twice the energy of the others, a real pusher, as one ranger called him. More than anything, Henry Musi loved to march men. He took obvious pleasure in the elan, the sweaty effort, the sheer kinetics of it. He had the drill sergeant's mysterious knack for being, or at least seeming to be, everywhere at once, seeing everything. He made himself heard, and he made sure the men believed what he believed. As he marched alongside the men, his coaching voice was clear and insistent, without being shrill, and it had an irresistible quality that said, "You can do anything." He didn't bellow or holler or swear, recalled Ranger Howard Baker. He didn't need to. He had such a forceful voice that when he wanted something done, it got done in a hurry. Musi was so charismatic you couldn't believe it, remembered Alvy Robbins. He had this air of total confidence about him. If you ever had to go to war, that's the kind of man you wanted to go with. Vance Shears put it this way. We all would have died for him. He was the very best. Even the sober, circumspect Captain Prince, grimacing from the pain of his blistered feet, was inspired by Musi's effervescence. The man was just a born salesman, Prince recalled. We knew he was selling us blue sky, but we would have followed him anywhere. Late afternoon was taking on the complexion of dusk. The sun's rays slanted low through the high grass, and the temperature began to drop from the infernal to the merely intolerable. A gusty breeze made a constant play of swirls and ripples in the Kogan, as though a distracted artist were beginning whimsical thoughts and ending them abruptly. As they snapped through the coarse grass, the men's collective mood was one of buoyant and almost carefree adolescence. They joked and jived with one another. They boasted about how many Japs they would kill. They toted their weapons like toys. The gathering zeal of the march, it seemed, had momentarily suppressed their sense of the mission's gravity. As one ranger described it, they could have been bounding off to a rugby match. After a half mile, the tall grass fields turned into rice paddies, a quilt of blonde stalks and black mud stretching to the highway. The men adjusted their gazes. All conversation, all joking, stopped. They squinted and shielded their eyes with cupped hands to break the glare. There it stood, a tattered city of thatch and razor wire swimming in the heat waves. The view was hazy but unobstructed, a straight shot south. The rangers were startled and at the same time a little relieved to lay eyes, finally, on the target after 3 days of thinking about little else, to affix an image to the strange word they'd been uttering since Musi first announced the mission. Cabanatuan. The camp was imposing in size and appeared to be well guarded, but even from their safe remove, the rangers could see that it was no impregnable citadel. The enclosure enjoyed no height advantages, no defensive works, no intervening obstacles of water. Rising only slightly above the vegetational haze, the compound consisted merely of barbed wire stretched taut across a field, with wooden towers studding the corners. In an ordinary strategic sense, taking it should pose no insurmountable problems. What made the target so intimidating was its emphatic isolation. Cabanatuan was a world unto itself, standing alone, a civilizational cyst. Nothing else broke the horizon for miles in any direction. Nothing but the one nipa shack in which Nellist and Vakilar had been crouched all afternoon. Musi and Prince surveyed the terrain with worried looks spreading over their faces. Trained to capitalize on the asset of surprise, rangers instinctively shied away from open ground such as this. Considering how well-armed his men were, Musi might have been willing to risk forfeiting surprise in this case, were he not also forced to consider the hair-trigger delicacy of the situation inside. One tiny mistake, he recognized, could provoke the very outcome they were trying to prevent, a slaughtering of prisoners. Prince gave the signal, and the men stepped forward, crouching in silence. They fanned out over the rice quadrants in broad waves of 30 men. Their boots crumped over the hard, cracked floors of the paddies, scattering flocks of field birds and reedy insects. Rice stalks rustled in a fickle breeze. The men were silent but for the random clicks and rattles of their weapons, the low friction of canvas rubbing canvas. After 100 yards of stooped marching, Prince gave another hand gesture, this one a signal to the men of F Company, releasing them on their separate errand. According to the plan, one platoon from F Company, 30 men in all, would break off from Prince's main group and, after describing a wide arc around the eastern perimeter, would assume attack positions in the rear of the camp. They had the longest way to go, and would thus need more time to reach their destination than Prince's C Company would. The rear of the camp was more than 800 yards away from the main gate, and impossible to see from the front of the enclosure, so Prince would have no way of knowing when F Company had arrived at its position. All of which explained why Prince had decided that F Company should initiate the raid by firing the first volley. The men of F Company's second platoon were led by a young lieutenant from Springfield, Massachusetts, named John Murphy. A sinewy man with a bony face and lugubrious, deep-set eyes, Murph, as nearly everyone called him, had graduated from Notre Dame and wanted to pursue a career in politics after the war. He was a cautious, understated leader in whom Musi and Prince had implicit confidence. Prince glanced over at Murphy and with a crisp wave sent the men of F Company on their way. Prince figured Murphy's group would need about an hour to skulk around to the back of the camp. If all went according to plan, the next sign of F Company would be the deafening report of their weapons firing on the rear guard towers, the unmistakable fillip that would set everything in motion. At approximately 5:45, Colonel Musi, Captain Prince, and some 90 C Company Rangers and Alamo Scouts resumed their march to the south, aiming directly for the main gate. After traversing one more square of rice, however, Prince concluded that the danger of detection was growing unacceptable. They had drawn within less than a mile of the camp, with the guard towers not only visible, but beginning to take on definition. Captain Prince lowered his hand in a sweeping gesture, and then all the rangers fell to the ground. For the remaining 3/4 of a mile, they would have to chart a slow, steady advance on their bellies, an army of snakes. Lying on the crusty floor of a paddy, the rangers strapped their rifles to their backs or held them out in front, loosely cradled in their arms. Then they dug their knees and elbows into the dirt and began inching forward, pulling themselves through the long straight rows of dried rice. The ground was strewn with old carabao dung, and the flat expanses were occasionally interrupted by shallow puddles, faintly spluttering with tadpoles and schools of tiny fish. At one point, a group of rangers disturbed an unseen nest, and armies of red ants skittered over them by the score, darting under their clothes, leaving trails of welts on their skin. Even though the men were hugging the ground, Prince began to fear that the Japanese would spot them anyway. The dikes that delineated the paddies were as hard and thick as brick walls, and more than 2 feet high in some places. Each time the rangers came upon one of these earthen dividers, they had to climb up and over, exposing themselves even more conspicuously for a few terrifying seconds before dropping down into the next quadrant. This awkward hop, performed by so many rangers in spasmodic intervals across the field, seemed like precisely the sort of unnatural movement that would snag a guard's attention. Yet for some reason, it didn't. Slowly, painstakingly, the rangers advanced another 500 yards with impunity, and another. They were smeared with mud and drenched in sweat. Their necks ached, their shoulders burned, their arms trembled from a hard hour's game of playing serpent. They were drawing tantalizingly close, close enough to see movement inside the compound and even make out the shapes of guards perched in the towers. When they passed by the lone nipa shack, Nellist and Bakilar, the two Alamo scouts who'd been patiently sitting out the afternoon inside, shinnied down the ladder and joined them. The late afternoon winds had gradually abated, and a leaden silence fell over the plain. The sun grew fat and luxuriant as it lowered itself beside Mount Ararat, the vast dormant volcano to the southwest. In the sanguinary light, the jagged ridgelines of the Sierra Madre to the east broke through in sharper, richer blues, and the haze of the fields seemed to lift. Prostrate before enemy sentinels, enveloped by open earth and open sky, strung out over nearly 100 yards, the men felt utterly exposed, as though the Shinto gods might be following their progress and waiting for the right moment to impale them. "I don't know why they didn't see us," recalled Ranger Alvy Robbins. "There was plenty of light. If they'd been really looking with their glasses, they could have seen that there's something going on out there that's not right." "I figured we had to just be about the luckiest people on earth," said Ranger Roy Peters. "The Lord had just closed those Japanese eyes where they couldn't see. That's the only way I could figure it." As the Rangers of C Company crept ever closer to the gates of Cabanatuan, Captain Prince's fear of being detected immeasurably deepened. Then, from the northwest, a godsend. They heard a low and indistinct rumble that seemed to emanate from deep within the ground, but in a few seconds it clarified into a more familiar sound, the clean, metallic hum of prop engines. A fighter was hurtling across the sky toward them at low altitude, coming from the direction of Lingayen Gulf. Soon the aircraft was on top of them, a strange-looking plane, black as anthracite. It had a long, capped snout, a swollen abdomen set with cannons, and sweeping black tails, two of them. There was a hooked needle stuck in its nose that looked vaguely like a stinger. Stair-stepping back from the cockpit was a confusing array of nacelles and bulbous lucite housings. On the side of the nose was painted a Zaftig nude, in the style of Vargas, with the hand-sketched moniker, "Hard to Get." Musi smiled as the plane shot past the camp. This menacing, insectile-looking thing was, he realized, the answer to his prayers. He'd asked for a plane, and the Sixth Army had provided one. In truth, Musi had half assumed that his request had been bungled, stuck somewhere in the vast mire of inexplicable snafus for which the Army was infamous. Instead, headquarters had come through with the most impressive new fighter in the U.S. Air Force. Hard to Get was a P-61, better known as a Black Widow. The Rangers had seen these strange twin-fuselage warbirds back in New Guinea, where they'd been introduced in the summer of 1944. Aside from its wicked appearance, what was most remarkable about the Black Widow was what it harbored inside its domed fiberglass proboscis. The P-61, newly sprung from the factories of Northrop, was the first American plane to be equipped with radar, in this case a large, cumbersome internal dish contraption known as the Radiation Laboratory SCR-720. The Air Force chose to paint the aluminum alloy skin a matte black because the plane was expressly designed to be a night fighter, employing radar to chase down targets from dusk to dawn. Earlier that afternoon, Musi's radio request for air cover had been forwarded by 6th Army Headquarters to an outfit called the 547th Night Fighter Squadron, the Air Force group that flew Black Widows from new airstrips set up along Lingayen Gulf. There were 38 pilots in the squadron, but the assignment to fly over the Cabanatuan camp went, more or less by luck, to a 26-year-old pilot from Rainier, Oregon, named Kenneth Schreiber. Accompanied by a radar specialist, Bonnie Rux, Schreiber took off just before 6 o'clock from a prefabricated airstrip fashioned out of pierced steel planking, a new material of connectable galvanized metal sheeting that enabled the Air Force to build in a matter of hours runways that once took weeks to construct. Climbing high above the blue scallop of Lingayen Gulf, Schreiber veered southeast, barreling straight over the central plain for Cabanatuan. For the Rangers, pinned down on the rice paddies, Hard to Get's grand entrance inspired awe. The arrival couldn't have been more perfectly timed. The plane banked low over the camp and roared across the Pampanga River, circling back for another pass. With their eyes fastened on the gloaming sky, the Rangers grinned at each other and shook their heads in delighted admiration. The Japanese were terrified. 6th Army Headquarters couldn't have dreamed up a more malevolent-looking aircraft to instill fear or attract attention. At first, the guards and transient troops scrambled for cover. For a short while, the scene inside the camp was one of utter confusion. Once the shock wore off, and the Japanese realized this probably wasn't an air raid after all. They simply stared up at the Black Widow, stared in wonder, consternation, and disbelief. They were transfixed. They'd never seen such a plane. Pilot Schrieber did his best to make hard-to-get behave as oddly as possible. Without firing a single shot, he performed a series of taunts and feints, wheeling and stalling and reversing directions. At one point, he killed an engine and let the plane falter as though it was crippled. Feathering the engine to make it sound as though it were fatally wheezing, he aimed the plane for a ridge of foothills miles in the distance, trying to convey the impression he was about to crash. For a few moments, he vanished behind the hills. Then, at the last possible second, he pulled out of it and turned back for another tease. On and on it went for 20 minutes, this coquettish dance in the twilight sky. Schrieber and Rux could see the Rangers creeping the fields, and clusters of spindly-legged POWs waving up at them from within the compound. If an emergency developed, the two airmen were prepared to strafe the Japanese with the 20mm cannons that were part of the Black Widow's onboard arsenal. Such an action would have brought its own dangers, however, and thankfully it wasn't necessary. The ruse appeared to be working precisely the way Captain Pahota hoped it would. The guards were looking skyward instead of groundward, and the Rangers were inching forward. Captain Juan Pahota and his force of 200 guerrillas had already taken their positions along Highway 5 to the northeast of the camp, spread out on either side of the road in a great V. Crouched low in the field stubble, holding Springfields and BARs, and manning large water-cooled 30-caliber machine guns set on tripods, they could see the Japanese camps clustered in the miasmal bottomlands of the Kabu, just a few hundred yards to the east. Large numbers of enemy tanks and armored vehicles were visible across the river, parked in the feathered thickets of bamboo. At times, in the shifting breeze, the Filipinos could hear muffled fragments of Japanese conversations. As they'd done for the past several nights, the enemy soldiers were cooking their dinners while there was still light. Fearing that bright flames might too clearly give away their position after dark, they would stamp out their fires by dusk to forestall an American air attack. Pahota's men were both frightened and excited to have the chance, finally, to confront the Japanese straight on. This was their first great battle. For the past 3 years, they'd been a phantom army, farmers by day, soldiers by night. They were skilled at picking off the enemy a few at a time, blowing out their truck tires, swiping their food, stealing their weapons. They were well-armed for the most part, carrying both pre-war Springfields and weapons of a more recent vintage that had been smuggled into the occupied Philippines by submarine. Yet some of Pahota's men were merely teenaged boys armed with nothing more than bolo knives. Pahota was heartened to find that the Japanese had neglected to station guards on the Kabu River Bridge. This oversight allowed Pahota's men to lodge some 20 landmines in the road. An explosives expert also succeeded in strapping a time bomb to the understructure of the bridge. The bomb was timed to detonate at 7:45. This calibration was a matter of supreme delicacy. If the bomb went off any earlier, the loud blast might prematurely set the Ranger raid in motion. If it exploded any later, substantial numbers of Japanese troops and vehicles might cross over the span, overwhelm the Filipinos, and join the battle at Cabanatuan Camp. Ideally, the bomb would go off precisely when Japanese armored vehicles were trundling across the planked floor of the bridge, thus taking down a few unsuspecting members of the onrushing enemy along with the structure. That, at least, was Pahota's firm hope. But in the tropical humidity of the Philippines, explosives quickly became corroded and were thus often unreliable. The odds were good, Captain Pahota realized, that the bomb would fail to detonate. This would leave his modest force of a few hundred men in an extremely precarious position. In a firefight with an entire mechanized battalion of Japanese troops, Pahota's men would then enjoy but one slim advantage, that of surprise. Approximately 1 mile away from Pahota's location, straight down Highway 5 toward Cabanatuan City, Captain Eduardo Hosen's forces had assumed their positions without incident. They were crouched in the irrigation ditches lining either side of the road, poised to annihilate anything that blundered down the road. Hosen scanned the empty highway and realized that, most likely, his was an all-or-nothing situation. Either he would see no action whatsoever, or he'd encounter an overwhelming force. Cabanatuan City was 4 miles away, close enough so that a convoy of Japanese vehicles could arrive within minutes should the garrison receive a distress call. Once the assault began, Hosen could only hope that the Japanese inside the camp would never get a chance to telephone their comrades in Cabanatuan City for help. Hosen knew that Captain Pahota had dispatched a few of his scouts to snip all telephone lines leading to the prison compound. Eventually, the guards would probably figure out that something was amiss and send a team of electricians to learn where the breaks in the line were. But for the moment, Cabanatuan lay incommunicado, marooned in the waning twilight. While Hosen and Pahota held their corresponding roadblocks on Highway 5, Lieutenant John Murphy and the 30 Rangers from F Company crossed under the highway, one by one. They crept through a culvert and emerged on the other side in a dry wash that coursed along the east edge of the camp. This ravine trended to the south and was deep and weedy enough to conceal the men from the Japanese guards for the first 100 yards. But then it grew progressively shallower until it played out altogether, emptying into a flat field where the grass was clipped short. Lieutenant Murphy could see that reaching the rear of the camp would require a slow, laborious crawl within frighteningly close range of one Japanese guard tower and 2 fortified pillboxes. An extremely wary platoon leader, one F Company man called him kind of a skittish, nervous little feller. Murphy had a bad feeling as he contemplated this extremely risky traverse. His hunch was borne out almost from the start. When the long line of 30 Rangers inched beneath the guard tower on the northeast side of the camp, the first in a gauntlet of manned installations they'd have to sneak past, one of the Imperial Army sentries suddenly blurted out a warning in Japanese and drew his rifle. The F Company men pressed themselves even closer against the bank of the arroyo. They felt sure they'd been spotted and prepared to leap up and charge the fence at the next unmistakable sign. Stealing peeks over the rim of the ditch, they could tell that the guard knew something was afoot. He was a mere 40 yards away, close enough so that the men could see that he was wearing eyeglasses. The sentry clutched his rifle and trained it nervously from side to side, aiming it straight at the ravine. The Rangers carried on a tense debate of whispers. "Shit, he's looking at us. Right at us. Should we blast him? No, Murph wants him to make the first move." The Rangers kept stone still in the ravine. The Japanese erupted in shrill discussion, but gradually the voices trailed off. After a few long minutes, the guard rested his rifle and appeared to relax, as though he'd decided the trouble either had passed or had merely been a vision of some kind, a figment of his bored ruminations. Murphy's F Company moved on. The men noticed that the Japanese guards had ceased looking down at the fields, that they seemed to be entirely focused on the sky. To Murphy's delight, the Black Widow was streaking impressively over the camp, and it proved to be a lifesaver for his platoon, just as it had been for Prince and his C Company. As the column of men writhed through the ditch, smaller groups of men fell out and took positions beneath each of the major Japanese fortifications along the eastern fence. There were 2 pillboxes and 2 guard towers, each of which appeared to be manned by 2 or 3 Japanese guards. The F Company plan was one of simple and decisive violence. Upon hearing the signal shot fired by Lieutenant Murphy in the rear, the men intended to annihilate these various nests simultaneously and with such concentrated force that the Japanese would have no opportunity to return fire. At approximately 7:30, the vanguard of F Company emerged from the ravine and crawled a final 200 yards on hard, open, well-mown turf. This was the part of the perimeter crawl that Murphy dreaded most. All that enabled them to pass through it was a bit of incredible good fortune. With the sun now completely set, the camp environs were plunged in darkness, and would remain so for only 25 minutes before a full moon would launch itself over the Sierra Madre, washing everything in bright silver light. The timing was extraordinary, as if a magical black veil had been thrown over them just when they needed it most. Though the rangers were no more than 20 yards away, the guards couldn't see them. "If there'd been even an ounce of light, we couldn't have made it that last stretch. No way," said William Proudfit of F Company. "But when we came out of that ravine, it was like ink." Sergeant Joe Youngblood, who was crawling alongside Proudfit, said he'd never seen a night so black in his life. "In the Philippines, when it got dark, it really got dark quick. We couldn't see our own rifles. We didn't have flashlights. It was a mystery how we saw enough to do anything." To reach their firing positions, the last remaining F Company men had to crawl, without realizing it, over the shallow, unmarked graves of untold numbers of Cabanatuan prisoners, coffinless crypts that had long since been plundered and disturbed by burrowing rodents and dogs. This was not the main Cabanatuan burial ground, but a smaller one, where, according to diagrams later found hidden inside the camp, the Japanese had interred the bodies of executed Americans. Sprawled among the moldered remains of their countrymen, the rangers squirmed across a field of pungent grass that smelled to some like wild sage. In the rear of the camp were several large Nipa barracks, where approximately 100 transient Japanese troops were quartered. If all went according to plan, every single one of these troops would be cut to pieces in what was supposed to be the raid's most ruthless point of attack. The barracks were situated off to themselves, in the extreme southern end of the camp, several hundred yards from the American section. The rangers planned to rake these Japanese billets with such intense fire that not a single occupant would have a chance to flee. Murphy knew that the last thing Captain Prince wanted was a surprise coming from the rear while the C Company men escorted the prisoners out the front gate. Lieutenant Murphy was supposed to fire the inaugural shot, and the gravity of that assignment was beginning to weigh on him. He glanced at his watch and saw that it was 7:40, 10 minutes past the scheduled starting time. It had taken a little longer than expected for him and his men to sneak all the way back to the rear. Along the full length of the fence, all the way around to the front, where Prince and his men were waiting in what must have been agonizing anticipation, Murph knew that every ranger ear was tuned to receive and instantaneously react to a single sound. He braced himself for the thunderous ferocity of 100 American weapons replying at once to his cue. It was a dazzling, unnerving feeling to hold such latent power in the tip of a digit. He brought his M1 rifle to his shoulder and switched off the safety. He drew a deep breath and settled his sights on a Japanese soldier inside the barracks, resting his index finger on the cool crescent of metal.